This is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. 3 years ago, a team of scientists in the Arctic Ocean came across one of the largest algal blooms ever documented. And here's the real kicker. It was under solid sea ice, something previously thought impossible. The discovery raised a slew of questions, like how was light getting through the ice? Was this a one-off or a regular occurrence we've just never observed? Or could this be an effect of climate change? After a few years of mulling things over, scientists returned to the Arctic this past spring to try to catch the beginning of an under-ice algal bloom and test their ideas. They also took along a handful of artists whose goal was to portray and respond to this massive phenomenon and the process of studying it. Things didn't go exactly as planned, but I'll let you hear that story directly from some of the people involved. Joining me now is physical oceanographer Bob Pickert of Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. He was one of the lead scientists on both the 2011 and 2014 expeditions. Bob, welcome to Living Lab.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
All right, set the scene. Where on the globe was this taking place? What part of the Arctic Ocean?
Okay, this is called the Pacific Arctic. So it's north of Bering Strait, and Bering Strait is the connection between the Pacific and the Arctic, and that's where all the Pacific water comes through. So we were in and about the region west and north of Alaska.
So in 2011, when you were out there, what was the goal of that cruise? Obviously, you weren't there looking for this completely unexpected discovery.
No, we were not. So this was a cruise that was funded by NASA, and it was, in fact, the first time that NASA has actually chartered a research vessel. You know, NASA does everything from space, so this was a big deal for them. And the purpose of the cruise was to really go out and take measurements in the on the ice and in the water to try to ground truth their satellite measurements.
So they talking about the satellite measurements of the thickness of the sea ice is what you were trying to?
Various things. Probably the biggest variable we were looking for was what they call ocean color. They actually take pictures, and if they see blooms, phytoplankton blooms, then that will show up as color. But they have all these measurements from space, and they're trying to quantify and understand how realistic are these measurements, how they can interpret these things. So that's why they wanted to take a boat out there and have scientists actually take the measurements right there and, you know, the real robust measurements, and then they can compare them to these proxies that they have from space.
So how did you actually discover that there was an algal bloom under the ice? How do you find something that you're not looking for?
Well, okay. So I just got through talking about ocean color. So, of course, we were measuring phytoplankton. That was one of the whole slew of measurements that we were taking on board. And, of course, as they take these measurements, they're paying attention to them and plotting them. And then all of a sudden, you know, one day we stumble upon this, you know, amazing bloom with these, you know, huge concentrations of chlorophyll. And, you know, I remember the day that the lead biologist came around saying, oh, my goodness, I can't believe what we just saw, you know. And then as we delved into a little bit more, as you said, you know, it turns out that this was one of the largest blooms ever recorded, not just in the Arctic, but anywhere in the world ocean.
So when you say largest, do you mean in terms of density or literally just the size, the area of ocean covered by it?
It was concentration of chlorophyll. Okay, we didn't have the time or the ability at that point to actually map out how large the bloom was. That's something that we were going to address later on, you know, once we got back and tried to get our act together. But just in terms of concentration, it was the largest or one of the largest. And also it extended quite deep in the water column. So quite, you know, deep down close to the bottom, which was also a bit of a surprise.
Why was it so surprising to find so much plankton there? I mean, we know that the Arctic Ocean has some of the richest waters, so why wouldn't we expect to see huge blooms like this?
Well, part of the reason is because you need nutrients to get these blooms, okay? And the nutrients are contained in a certain type of water, and we call this winter water, all right? It comes through Bering Strait in the winter, and it's got all these high nutrients on it. But as time progresses, this water sort of flushes off the shelf to the north. And in order to get the bloom, you have to get sunlight into the ocean, okay? So as long the previous thinking was, as long as there's ice on the water, you're not going to get the sunlight through. So meanwhile,
why not? I mean, ice is often clear. Could a little bit of sunlight not filter through?
So it is clear, but if it's thick enough, then it's just you're not going to get enough through. That's number one. But number two is also you get snow on top of the ice, and that's the real killer. You get just a little thin layer of snow on that ice, and it's going to reflect most of the sunlight coming from space. So the idea then was that, okay, so by the time the ice opens up, most of that high nutrient water is already gone. And that's why, you know, we didn't expect to see such a big bloom.
Well, what are the ideas for how light then is getting through the ice if it seems physically impossible for it to do so?
So what we deduced was that the light was coming through what we call melt ponds. And essentially what happens is as the spring progresses and the air gets warmer, you start to melt the ice. And it melts these little ponds all around the pack ice. And as the ice scientist terms it, these can be sort of considered as skylights. They allow more light to come through. So if you're looking like in the ocean, looking above at the ice, you see all these, you know, areas of light coming through, and then they just expand out and you're illuminating a good part of the water column.
Those melt ponds have gotten a lot of press in recent years as being one effect of climate change, one of the symptoms of the melting Arctic. So do you think that this massive bloom you encountered and blooms like this are a climate change impact? Do we have enough information to know that?
Well, that's what we're thinking. Okay, so let's go back two decades ago when you had multi-year ice, which was, you know, quite thick. Because you just didn't melt it during the summer. And there you had all these ridges and stuff, and you're just not getting enough light through. And also, it's just not cold enough in the summer to start really melting it significantly. All right. Now, today, what's happened because of the warm climate is we're getting melting, and then it will melt completely back in the summer. All right. So now that you have open water, and then you start again in the winter. So you're only getting these thin layers of ice each year. This first year ice is what we call it. And those are much more, able to have the light penetrate through. And especially if you start melting it, you know, as the spring progresses.
So it's possible that these blooms are an impact of climate change. But if we've never really looked for them, the fact that we've never seen them before, we can't ever really know definitively.
Absolutely, we don't. All right. And what's kind of interesting here is that, like, for instance, NASA making estimates from space, people are estimating how much of the primary production is happening in the Arctic. And it's always been assumed that this happens after the ice melts away in the summertime. All right. And it could be that we're missing a good portion or maybe even most of the phytoplankton that's growing because it's happened underneath the ice before, you know, we just didn't realize it was there.
How important would that be to our understanding of how the oceans work, how the climate works, if these have always been there?
Okay. Well, first of all, we actually don't think they've always been there because, like I said, when you have the multi-year ice and it stays the whole summer, then you're just not going to get enough light in there to get the big blooms. But now what we think is happening is when you are getting the big blooms, it's changing the timing of the bloom. OK, as I said earlier, typically what was happening before is later in the summer when the ice retreats, that's when you get the bloom. But now if the ice is thin enough, you're getting the bloom a month or maybe 2 months earlier. All right. And that's going to alter the timing of the entire seasonal ecosystem. OK, you're having this bloom of plants happening earlier in the season. And then what happens is the zooplankton come and feed off these plants. Right. And they're usually invected in or mostly invected in from or brought in from the Pacific Ocean at a certain time. And that's their food source. And now all of a sudden the food has come and gone a month earlier. They have nothing to feed on. And then, you know, it just goes right on up the food chain. You know, the fish are going to eat the zooplankton, right? The seals and the whales are going to eat the fish. Then the polar bears are involved. So this could change the whole timing of it. And we don't know what some of the ramifications will be.
I mean, that doesn't necessarily sound like a bad thing, per se, to have a much richer food source there.
You're right. We just don't know. There's going to be some losers and probably some winners, but this is all new ground. We just don't know what the ramifications are.
In case you're just joining us, I'm talking with physical oceanographer Bob Pickert about the discovery of a massive algal bloom underneath solid sea ice in the Arctic in 2011. Joining me now, Ben Harden, a postdoctoral researcher and outreach coordinator in Pickert's group. He's also a videographer and radio producer in his own right. Ben, welcome.
Hi, good to be here.
And also Chelsea Clark. She is a Cape Cod-based fabric and print artist who produced daily drawings during this year's expedition, returning to the Arctic to study this phenomenon, also working on a larger body of work based on the cruise. Welcome.
Thank you.
Now, Bob Pickert, you've been talking to us about this biology of the algal blooms and what the ramifications may be, but you're the first to say I'm a physical oceanographer, not a biological oceanographer. So what kind of team had to be put together, science team, to go back out and study a bloom this year when you try to go back mm-hmm. and really dig into this phenomenon?
So we needed three components. I'm the physical oceanographer, as you just said. So I study, you know, where the water moves, where the nutrients are going, which of course is a big part of the story. And then we need an ice scientist, okay? And that's of course having to do with how the ice is getting, how the light is getting through the ice. And then of course we need the biologist. So we had sort of a three-pronged approach And, you know, we were on the research vessel Healy, a Coast Guard vessel. It had 48 berths, and we filled them all.
48 people, three different teams. I mean, that's a lot of people to try to coordinate.
It is. It's a lot of people to try to coordinate, and it's quite a challenge. You know, because we have, in some ways, we compete. A lot of times, we can't measure what we want to in the ocean at the same time as we're measuring from the ice. So, you know, that ice team will step up and get excited and go out and do their stuff, and then they have to stand down and let the biologists and the physical oceanographers do their thing. So there's a little bit back and forth through the whole cruise to try to, you know, everyone has a decent amount of time to do their thing.
You were one of three lead scientists.
That's correct.
So there's no one person at the top. I mean, is there ever kind of a two-on-one, we win, and this is what we're going to do situation that crops up?
In theory, that could have happened, but it didn't happen. What I felt good about is I got to tell us where the boat was going. As a physical oceanographer, you know, knowing where the currents are or, you know, trying to deduce where the nutrients were going to be, that's such an important part of the story. I was able to sort of drive the ship. So that was good.
So you were happy with the power that you had?
I was happy with that power. Although, you know, after the 12th ice station, I was getting, okay, it's time to get back to the physical oceanography.
Now, Ben Hardin, you are a researcher, but your position on this particular cruise was as outreach coordinator. How odd did it feel to you to not really be directly involved in the science? And what were you actually doing on this cruise? How did you occupy your time?
Oh, yeah. I was organizing the outreach team for the cruise. It's a little bit of a different job to my day-to-day, you know, sitting in front of the computer and, you know, analyzing ocean data or being a scientist on other cruises. But, you know, Bob and other people have been really supportive in allowing me to kind of go out and exercise this other part of my career, which is to, you know, communicate the science and to coordinate a team who will, you know, coordinate to communicate the science together. And so we had a diverse team came along on this expedition. We had myself, a photographer, Amanda Kowalski, Chelsea sitting to my left, who is a visual artist. We had a choreographer and dancer, Jody Sperling. And we had Dallas Murphy, who's a writer who's been on this show before. And we also had a teacher from California who was there to coordinate an effort to kind of communicate with school teachers and students.
So really, it wasn't three teams on board, it was four teams.
Yeah, kind of. Yeah.
Yeah.
All with their own demands. I think the outreach team had enough demands as
That's
well.
Right. And I wonder if there were more births, there would have been more outreach.
Well, so why is that? Why is it so important to you and worth, you know, saying that there are this many scientists who can't come on this cruise because it's important enough to us to have a handful of artists on board?
Well, you know, we get our funding from the government. And that's from the taxpayers. And we have to be able to communicate effectively to the lay public what we do as scientists and why it's important. And we're finally realizing that as scientists. And so that's why it's really important to have an outreach component. And I've been really blessed to be able to work with a good team. And, you know, Ben has been with me, I think, three or four times now. So and each time we're getting better at it. And it just makes a great difference.
Chelsea Clark, how did you get involved with this expedition and what drew you to it?
So I went to a book talk by Dallas about his book from a previous cruise with Bob. And afterwards, I went up to Dallas to talk to him to ask how he got involved with this, because I always have been really interested in science and how the living world works and trying to use my artwork to communicate sort of a lot of the beauty and complexity that people might not know about. And I've been interested in working with scientists for a while, but not really sure how to make that connection. And Dallas sort of pointed at Bob, who was standing next to him, and said, "Talk to Bob." And I did. And Bob actually offered that I could go on the cruise on the spot. And I didn't think that he was serious, but he was.
I wonder if you think that being here on Cape Cod lends itself to that dual interest in science or nature, the natural world, and also art. I mean, we have such a concentration of scientists and then also artists. But as you said, the two communities tend to be somewhat separate.
Yeah, I do think it has a lot to do with it. I mean, I grew up in a place where being a scientist to me seemed like the best, most practical career path you could have. Like, of course,
and everyone, it seems normal around
yeah,
here.
Yeah, it's normal. That's what everyone would want to be. Like, why wouldn't you want to be a scientist? That's what most people are. was sort of the impression that I had growing up, that that's kind of the majority of what people do is be scientists. And I think there's a part of me that always wanted to do that, but I was also really drawn to the art. And I'm not so much interested in finding, you know, doing the research to find out how things work as sort of having someone else distill it for me. And then I distill it further and pick out the things about it that I find most fascinating.
All right, that's visual artist Chelsea Clark. Also with me, Ben Harden and Bob Pickert. We're talking about their cruise to the Arctic Ocean earlier this year, trying to explore unexpected algal blooms underneath sea ice. We'll hear more of the story after a short break. This is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. Science doesn't always go according to plan. In 2011, a group of scientists in the Arctic Sea stumbled on something unexpected, a massive algal bloom underneath solid sea ice. Earlier this year, an expedition returned to the Arctic with the goal of answering some of the persistent questions about how such a thing could happen. Physical oceanographer Bob Pickert of Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution was one of the lead scientists on both the 2011 and 2014 expeditions. Ben Harden is a postdoctoral researcher and outreach coordinator in Pickert's group. And also with us is Chelsea Clark, a Cape Cod-based fabric and print artist who produced daily drawings during the expedition. Bob Pickert, what was the plan for this expedition? What did you think was going to happen when you headed out to the Pacific Arctic in May of this year?
We wanted to essentially get out on this icebreaker for the entire spring season. That was the goal. And we actually proposed to do back-to-back 35-day cruises. And what we wanted to do is we wanted to get up into the Arctic before any of this bloom started.
Why would that be important?
Because we wanted to measure what you might call the initial conditions. You know, why, what conditions would allow such a massive bloom to develop? Then we wanted to, you know, make our measurements, understand the background, and then position ourselves to actually measure the bloom. And then, of course, we wanted to finish off by, once the ice starts to melt, let's see what happens in the open water. You know, because as I said earlier, everyone used to think that it all happened in the open water. But now, if most of it's happening underneath the ice, what's left to happen in the open water? So we wanted to see that as well.
To be out there for that full season, I mean, you're talking about, what, May till almost September is when we typically see the sea ice minimum. Is it realistic to think that you could get a team out there for that whole summer?
Absolutely not. So we had to choose. And like I said, we wanted the initial conditions. So that meant going out. We wanted to get out in April. Okay. We weren't allowed to for several reasons. But starting then, and then, you know, perhaps up through July is what we were aiming for. Because that's, we really wanted to be there for when the melting ponds, you know, the ponded ice happened. And then, as I said, we would move it just a little bit further to the south and get into the open water and see that contrast.
How different was the situation from what you were hoping for when you arrived?
Well, that's a good question. So we were nervous and we were pushing hard to try to get out in April, but there were a lot of constraints. And one of them is that there's really only one science vessel, Icebreaker, operated by the Coast Guard, and it has maintenance that it has to do. So, you know, it has a certain amount of stuff and then it can go. So after a lot of negotiation, you know, we agreed on going out in early May. And we were hoping that was early enough before any of the activity started. So we sailed through Bering Strait, I think it was May 13th, and we did our first set of measurements. And, you know, what we were hoping to find is this whole bunch of this winter water I told you about, this high nutrient cold winter water. And instead, what we saw was summer water. OK, and what happens here, and we know that this happens, is that as the season progresses, you essentially get a flood of warm water coming through Bering Strait. And it's essentially, you know, works its way through the area that we were interested in. And so we saw this warm water and was like, uh-oh, are we too late? You know, we were a little bit nervous that, oh, gosh, we've missed our chance to get out there and get this initial condition. So at that point, you know, we tried to beeline it as fast as we could up into the northern part of the shelf.
Ben Harden, part of what you were doing on this cruise was documenting life on board. What happened in terms of the psyche of the crew when you get out there and very early in the cruise, you already have this setback, essentially, that we're too late. We may have missed it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I did a video with Bob straight off the bat as we're coming through Bering Strait. You know, this is a fantastic, you know, portion of the world, this tiny little strait that connects the massive Pacific Ocean with the Arctic. And we took our first measurements across there and Bob was immediately worried. And that kind of spread throughout the rest of the boat that we needed to kind of get north as quickly as possible. Otherwise, we were going to be too late for this. So, you know, the psyche was still optimistic. You know, we didn't know how far this warm water had, like, progressed into the Arctic. So, you know, but there was definitely a rush on. We were going to do another section just north of that, weren't we? But we decided to miss that one out in order to kind of get north quickly. Otherwise, we were going to miss it.
Chelsea, what were you drawing at this point? Were you kind of waiting for the bloom to materialize?
So I was getting to know all the scientists and grad students and talking to them, trying to learn as much as I could about what we were there to do, what they were studying, sort of gathering ideas for what I would want to concentrate on and what sort of what bigger work could come out of it and what I wanted to focus the drawings on. And yeah, kind of impatiently waiting for the plankton with everyone else.
Bob, you said you wanted to beeline north, but you don't really beeline through Arctic sea ice. So talk about what it actually took to get to where you wanted to be.
Right. You don't beeline through Arctic ice. In fact, we knew that from the 2011 expedition when we were trying to get to a certain place and trying to bash through a ridge. And you do what's called backing and ramming. You know, you essentially just try to get enough momentum, get the ship going fast enough, and you try to jam through a ridge. And if you don't make it, you slide back and you try again. And in 2011, we did that 140 times once to try to get through a ridge to get to an ice station. And we sort of learned our lesson this time that you're not going to waste so much time. Nonetheless, you have to pick and choose where you're going. And as we were beelining it north, you know, we had some ideas of where to go. And we had to say, okay, we're not going to get there. You know, you can't get there from here. And you back up and go with plan B. So it was, you know, sort of picking and choosing our way through this very dynamic ice field that has lots of roadblocks.
Chelsea, I'm a sailor and I never tire of hearing people's first impressions of being on an icebreaker, being on a ship that is ramming its way through solid instead of liquid. What was that like?
It was amazing. Like, so for one thing, I had expected a flat sheet of ice, you know, nothing, just flat white to the horizon, which was not the case at all. There's all this topography, like big, looks like plate tectonics happening, which I think is what's happening. Big ridges being pushed up and all this rubble fields. And it's also really hard to get a sense of scale. Like, you look out and you can't tell if these ridges are 10 feet tall or 1 foot tall. So it was amazing. I was really lucky. I got to go up in the bridge and sit and watch the ice for hours. And yeah, there was a lot more variety than I was expecting.
Any trepidation, any fear about being on a ship in the middle of the sea ice?
Not much. I think the thing that I actually was most apprehensive about was what we were going to eat after we had been out there for a while.
So what were you eating?
At the beginning, the food was fantastic. But toward the end, we ate a lot of tater tots. I think that was sort of a funny fear to have, but that was actually my thing that I was the most worried about.
Ben Hardin, what was the rest of the outreach crew doing at this point? I mean, there was a lot of information going out to the public in real time. On the receiving end of that, following the cruise, it almost felt like there was a little bit of an effort to maybe portray that spirits were higher than they were, trying not to say we're disappointed, we're worried, we're fearful, trying to say this is all going great and we're still going to get there.
I mean, at the beginning of expeditions, you know, the outreach teams I've worked with before always, you know, finding their feet. You're on a new vessel, maybe, you know, you're working with new people. You're, you know, at times, you know, working with completely new sciences. I mean, I've done most of my work on physical oceanography, biological oceanography, and sea ice was, you know, a brand new field for me. And so, you know, getting your feet and finding out from the other scientists what they're going to do is one activity that you're doing. In terms of portraying a kind of more buoyant mood than was actually on the ship, I mean, Bob was most concerned because of his, you know, physical oceanography knowledge and of what this warm water meant. Other people, you know, were still in the mode of sorting out all their equipment. You know, the fact is that all of these guys who were going up there to make the measurements, yes, they had this hypothesis and the thing they wanted to look for, but they were also going into waters that people haven't been into and extensively studied at this time of year. This is, you know, brand new, groundbreaking, you know, science, regardless of the particular hypothesis they're going after. So, yeah, there was a mood of a little bit of apprehension, but at the same time, everyone's super excited about the prospect of just being there anyway.
That's Ben Hardin. He was outreach coordinator on a cruise this spring to the Arctic, trying to look for under ice algal blooms, also Chelsea Clark, a visual artist, and Bob Pickert, physical oceanographer and one of the lead scientists on the cruise. Bob Pickert, you had some political issues to deal with. You've got to one side of you the Russian border and to the other side of you indigenous Alaskan populations. And you really had to find your way between all those. So talk about the politics of this.
Yes, some big challenges. So as you just stated, Heather, yes, the Russian convention line splits the Chukchi Sea shelf right in half. So all of a sudden we're limited to the right half and not the left half. So that was a challenge that we knew about that challenge. And we also knew about the other challenge that you mentioned, and that is the whale migration happens at this time of year. And these are bowhead whales, and they migrate from the Pacific to the Northern Arctic, and they go right through Bering Strait, right along the coast of Alaska on their way up there. And there are several communities, small communities, that go and do their, you know, their sustenance whale hunting. And it's a very big deal, rightfully so, for them and for their communities. It's part of their culture. And so we presented our plan to the Alaska Eskimo Whaling Commission beforehand and said, this is what we'd like to do. And of course, they were nervous about it. There's a perception that this big, noisy icebreaker will scare whales away. So they're concerned. So we had to work, you know, with them to try to come up with a plan that's not going to impact them too much. But what was kind of funny is that after this meeting we had, our area of operation shrunk to this tiny little portion of the shelf, which just wasn't going to work. I mean, it was just too small and too far away from where we wanted to be. So we had to go back and work with them. And we also brought a community observer on board to act as a liaison between the scientists and the native communities. And once we got that communication going during the cruise, And they saw that we were willing to work with them, things opened up a bit more. And we pretty much were able to go just about everywhere we wanted to, as long as we did it, you know, with the right timing, not to disturb them if they were going out for a particular day. You know, we'll just stand back or we'll go at night or whatever. So we worked it out.
Was the ecological ramifications of these under ice blooms ever part of that conversation, explaining to them how what you were learning could really be important to them to understand the whales that they were hunting?
Absolutely. And they realized that. And that's why they're entering the dialogue with us, you know, because they realize it is going to benefit, you know, their whaling activities and their understanding of their environment. So, it was very open communication two ways.
Chelsea, was all of this politicking at all a surprise to you coming into this as kind of a novice to the, you know, at least scientific expeditions?
A little bit, but I had spent time in Alaska before, actually, so I did have a little bit of background on the Alaska natives and that they have the right to hunt things that other people can't and what a big deal that is. So I wasn't necessarily expecting it, but I wasn't really surprised either.
Now, you did eventually get to where you wanted to be. So where was that and what did you find? How did you know you'd gotten to the right spot?
Okay, so after our beelining, we made it up to one of the sections that we had occupied in 2011. And it was across something that we call the Central Channel, a little trough in the shelf, and we took our section across it. And as Ben mentioned earlier, this is the first time that anyone's been up there doing a broad-scale survey of the Chukchi Sea in this time of year. And we wanted to see this winter water. In 2011, we saw little bits of the winter water near the bottom. So we did this first section, and the entire water column from bottom to top was filled with this winter water that was completely, you know, saturated in nutrients. And that was an amazing moment. I remember even with our first cast, you know, the lead biologist was right next to me and we gave each other high fives. It's something we've never seen before. We hypothesized that that's the case. We hypothesized that most of the shelf was filled with this winter water, but we were actually seeing it and documenting it.
That's got to be really self-affirming. I mean, you came up with the right answer and you confirmed it.
It was an amazing moment. Yeah. And it was one of, you know, we had three teams, we had three sets of hypotheses, and one of the physical hypotheses was, you know, that it was filled with winter water. And yes, we affirmed it right there.
Now, there were a lot of measurements going on along the way, obviously, to know where you were in the sense of what the ocean was doing underneath you. And I understand you tried to be present every time the instruments went overboard. Is this going on around the clock? Did you not sleep for a week or more on end?
I can verify that he did not sleep for a lot of the cruise.
Yes, you like to watch every single cast that goes in the water and see what you have, because frankly, you have to make decisions on the fly. I mean, it's more complex than I just said. You know, the winter water comes through, but it comes through with these pathways, and these pathways are complex, and we're trying to figure them out. So depending on what you see on a given station, you know, I said I was the one steering the boat. Well, I'm going to change my mind, and we might go somewhere else or change the resolution of the stations to try to sort out, you know, what's going on. I do want to mention one other thing. You know, yes, I didn't sleep, but I don't think the outreach team slept either. So I think we're all in this together. You know, just like Ben said, it's a very exciting environment.
I mean, you could probably say that for the entire ship. You know, it's an exciting moment to be out there. You've got 40 days at sea to get everything you want done. And, you know, you just need to make the most of that in every way, be it the outreach team or any of the science teams.
I didn't want to go to bed and miss anything. And also the light, it doesn't get dark. So you kind of want to be up all the time, like, what's going to happen in the night? What's the light going to do? What if I go to sleep and we see polar bears? I didn't want to miss anything.
Is that the usual atmosphere on a research expedition? Is that every time you go to sea that kind of intense curiosity takes hold of you? Or was that something unique to this particular cruise?
This was a particularly special expedition. You know, it's not often that you get this thick into early season ice. And, you know, we were in the ice for 40 days. We had 24-hour sunlight. We were seeing polar bears. We were seeing walruses. We were doing groundbreaking science, you know, looking in an area that no one had looked before. It was probably more exciting than most oceanographic expeditions are, where you're out on the open ocean and maybe you're a long way from land. You get to see very little variation on a day-to-day basis, and people tend to slip into a bit more of a routine. This one was just, you know.
Yes, I concur. Whenever you can go to a place that, you know, or a time that no one's done before, it just, you know, raises the level of excitement. And in this case, we had a bunch of hypotheses, and we wanted to see if they were true. And being the first to be able to address these hypotheses made it extra special.
That's Bob Pickert, physical oceanographer, one of the lead scientists on an expedition to the Arctic to study under ice algal blooms earlier this year. Also, Ben Harden, outreach coordinator, and Chelsea Clark, one of the visual artists on board for the cruise. The conclusion of this twisting, turning science story after a short break. Welcome back to Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. We've all been there before. You make a plan, you do your homework, and then everything falls apart anyway. So what do you do next? Well, when you're on a research vessel in the middle of the Arctic Ocean, you can't just pack it in and go home. You have to make the best of it. That's basically what happened to a team of scientists earlier this year when they headed out to investigate a previously unknown phenomenon, previously thought impossible: massive algal blooms underneath solid sea ice. Physical oceanographer Bob Pickert, oceanographer and multimedia producer Ben Harden, and visual artist Chelsea Clark were all part of that expedition. Bob Pickert, you made it to the sweet spot. You found what you thought were the perfect conditions, and even then, Mother Nature wouldn't really cooperate with this cruise. So what happened next?
Okay, yes, we found sweet spot, which took a lot of time, and we were all poised for the big bloom to happen. And historically, what happens is just around the 1st of June, the temperature starts to get warm enough, and the winds tend to shift. Okay, so they're not coming out of the north so often, but sometimes they're coming out of the south, and that brings even more warm air. So we were in our sweet spot. We planned on having a three-day ice station to try to measure the beginnings of one of these blooms. And we're out there the first day, everyone's taking their measurements, and we see the precursors of these melt ponds. You know, just the ice is becoming gray. And the level of excitement, you know, maybe Ben can talk about this, was pretty high at that point. You know, we're just where we want to be, and we're seeing what we want to see. And then we wake up the next day, the wind's coming out of the north, and there's a layer of snow on the ice. And it's like, oh my goodness, you know, the snow is just going to reflect all that light right back up to space, and we're not going to get the light through. And what was worse was that the weather forecast called for 10 straight days of northerly winds. So that's like, you know, someone, you know, bursting your bubble. All of a sudden, the conditions that we need, we're not going to see.
And that 10 days would take you to the end of your allotted
just
time.
Just about take us to the end of our allotted time.
Ben Harden, while you were on the ice station, one of the artists with you, as you mentioned, was a choreographer and dancer. And she created just a really mesmerizing dance piece. The video you can find online, and we'll have it on our website as well. What was the response of the science teams and the crew watching her out on the ice dancing. That's not a sight that even the most veteran scientist would have ever seen on an expedition before.
Right, yeah. And, you know, actually, probably more than that, this whole outreach effort was probably a little larger than most scientists are used to. You know, a lot of people are bringing bloggers now on their expeditions, but to have this size and scale of an outreach program was kind of unprecedented in itself. The dancing, yeah, it was the most out there thing we were doing, and it had a mixed response at times, but you know, it was you've got to try these things, and you've got to give these people the opportunities to get out there and show what they can do and express themselves in their art. And you know, you're not always going to get the positive responses, but you know, a lot of people found it incredibly motivating and incredibly beautiful. And you know, I think it was a great success.
There was a big gawk factor in the beginning, not only the crew, but the science party as well. But we all got over that. And you know, once Jody was able to explain, you know, what her goals were, you know, it did make sense. And to see her out there doing her thing, it really impacted you. And Ben said that some of the crew members filmed her too. So what I think happened is that the crew got more and more interested in this project and in Jody, and then they offered to get out there and actually do some of the filming themselves. And I thought that spoke volumes.
The crew was incredibly helpful, like at every turn for the whole outreach team. I would ask for something that I thought was like completely unreasonable, or there's no way they'll possibly have this on this ship in the middle of the ocean, and they would like produce it magically.
Like
for
what?
Me. Bubble wrap, for example. It's like, you don't happen to have any bubble wrap, do you? And they brought me down into this like deep hold and gave me a giant roll of bubble wrap.
Of course, industrial size.
Yeah. But that, like, things like that just kept happening. Jody wanted a piece of plywood, and they came up with a piece of plywood, and like anything that you could wish for, they would go out of their way and find it for you.
Bob, the eventual conclusion of this particular cruise, as you've already hinted at, is essentially you ran out of time and you never really did get to the bloom. Is that right?
That's correct. We did not see our massive phytoplankton bloom. We saw the initial conditions. We saw everything leading up to it. But the final stage, we did not witness.
And you've told me that the 2011 cruise, the initial discovery of this got a lot of press because it was so surprising. And you had a number of journalists who were interested in following this expedition until they realized the ending of the story.
Yes, I think what happened was afterwards, you know, there were some interviews that we had and, you know, interest expressed. And then, you know, as when they found the ending of the story, it was that, well, we didn't really see the bloom after all. You know, there was less interest. There's no doubt about that.
Ben Hardin, as a storyteller yourself with your video and radio production, how did you handle the ending to this story? What did it mean to you that you never actually did get to find the bloom?
Yeah, as you say, as a storyteller, you go into a story sometimes with an idea of what the arc's going to be. You know, very clearly Bob had come up with this hypothesis, and we were going to go out there and we were going to see the bloom and measure it for the first time ever, and it was going to be this, you know, wonderful story arc that then started, you know, slipping away day by day as we realized we weren't going to see this. But you know, the inspiring thing for me was the switch up I had to make at that point. And the inspiration for that came from the scientists themselves. They were not destitute. They were not, you know, at their wits' ends, pulling their hair out about not seeing this thing. As I said before, they're in a new place, studying things that people haven't studied before. Yes, they missed the hypothesized algal bloom, but you know, these ice scientists got to study the effect of a late snowstorm on the melting of an entire huge portion of ice. The biologists got to study the algal communities that cling to the bottom of the ice. You know, Bob got to take an extensive survey of the water pathways and the flow through the Chukchi Sea. This is all inspiring stuff that doesn't fit into a nice narrative arc, but it just tells you something about how this kind of science works. It's explorative. It's not something that you can just, you know, set up in a lab.
Chelsea, in addition to the daily drawings you did on the cruise, you were using the cruise as the research for a larger body of work. How did the unexpected arc of this expedition impact what you have planned?
I wouldn't say it had a huge impact. I was hoping to see more plankton, more different kinds of plankton. I was incredibly lucky. The scientists let me be really involved in a lot of the research. I got to look through microscopes and draw plankton directly from the microscope. So I was hoping to see more kinds of plankton and be able to draw more different kinds and get a better idea. I was using the cruise sort of as a way to build up an image bank of plankton to hopefully make a bigger installation. And part of what I wanted to do was have the different kinds of plankton at the appropriate depth and sort of time in the plankton bloom. And I wasn't able to get as good of a picture of that as I would have liked. And some of the plankton I was drawing from photos from the internet. But overall, I don't think it held me back very much, but I would have liked to have seen more. And especially, I would have liked to have gotten a better idea what the effect on the food chain would be, because I'm very interested in that and portraying that.
Bob Pickert, that's where this particular cruise ends, but it's not really where the story ends.
That's right. It's not.
You decided, okay, well, we don't have any more time on board a ship here, but there's another cruise coming back to the Arctic, so let's see if they can help us out. So
what happened there was that the next mission on the Healy was going to a similar area, a little bit further north, a little bit further to the east. So I essentially had to twist the arm of the chief scientist to try to explain to him what was going on. And, you know, maybe he could alter his cruise track just a little bit to try to take some of these measurements and get the tail end of one of these booms. Well, lucky for me, the chief scientist of that mission was myself. So I had an easy time twisting my own arm. And we went out there.
And once again, you were driving the ship.
So I got to say. So we did our homework. We found out exactly where the ice was. We talked earlier about this warm water flooding into the Chukchi Sea. And as it does so, the ice recedes with it. So our sweet spot from the earlier cruise was no longer a sweet spot. It was in open water. So we had to go much further north. And we went up there. That's the first thing we did. Beelined it again. And we took a beautiful section in the northern part of the shelf. And we saw it wasn't the end of the bloom. We saw the beginnings of the under ice bloom.
Hmm. So yet another unexpected twist. The plan to stay there then and watch it bloom?
Absolutely. So we were, again, very excited. At the last second, the biologists had scrambled to put a couple of biologists on board because they knew this was happening. So we had a small core of measurements to take. So we were poised to do it. But then again, it wasn't Mother Nature this time. It was something else. But we were throwing another curveball. And that was that there was a sailboat in distress off of Point Barrow. And we had to stop our science operations and go do a search and rescue mission to try to assist this sailboat.
Because, of course, you're on a Coast Guard icebreaker.
We are on a Coast Guard icebreaker. So we realize, you know, what that means. And in this type of situation, you know, I couldn't argue. You know, this is what the Coast Guard has to do. The problem was it was 200 miles away. It was through ice. You know, it took us a day and a half to get over there. Then we had to do the rescue mission, which thankfully was successful, and it was not life-threatening. But at that point, I was not going to turn back around and go another day and a half back to that study area because we had to get on with our other science. So we lost our second chance in one season to see this.
Will you be going back next year or in future years to try yet again to find one of these blooms?
Absolutely. Absolutely. We were already talking about the proposal that we'd be writing while we were still on the ship in the first mission. And we are actually writing the proposal as we speak, and we'll submit it next week, and we hope to get out there in 2016.
Bob Pickert, Chelsea Clark, Ben Hardin, thank you all.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You can find video of that Coast Guard rescue on our website, capeandislands.org. We've also got links to the Arctic Spring Expedition website, including videos produced by Ben Hardin and the daily drawings posted by Chelsea Clark. Now from one ocean mystery to another, you may have heard last summer that starfish on the West Coast were seemingly melting away, literally turning to mush and dying. Some pointed their fingers at climate change or even radiation from Fukushima. For the record, that is definitely not the culprit. Scientists say it's a disease that's affecting as many as 20 kinds of starfish, and not only in the Pacific. Here in New England, the common starfish is suffering the same fate. Amy Kolb-Noyes has our story on efforts to track down the cause.
On a clear, bright morning in late August, a group of kids crowds around a touch tank aboard an Ocean Quest Discovery cruise off the coast of Cape Cod. The kids range in age from toddlers to teenagers, and each of them are eager to reach into the tank and pluck out a crab, whelk, or starfish. Fox Carey is a marine biologist who spends his summers in Woods Hole introducing kids to sea creatures.
Net over the side and we'll tow it for a little while and bring it in.
The touch tank is the highlight of the Ocean Quest trip. And Carrie says starfish are many of the kids' favorite catch.
No matter how fearful people are of the spider crabs and the lobsters, virtually nobody is afraid of a starfish, so we try to grab as many as we can.
But in recent years, Carrie says both the number and the size of the starfish have been on the decline.
I can definitively remember a noteworthy effect in the size of the starfish starting about 2 years ago. And they were much harder to find, almost impossible to find larger ones, and the smaller ones disappeared.
Carrie's observations are consistent with what other marine scientists have reported on both coasts. Many are blaming the decline on a yet-to-be-identified starfish wasting disease. Roxana Smolowitz is a professor at Roger Williams University and a veterinarian who specializes in diseases of aquatic animals. She says starfish seem to just melt away from the disease.
What you have basically is a starfish that might look relatively normal one day, and the next day it has white spots on the surface, or it may have dropped a leg, and it will be kind of mushy. When you pick it up, it'll just be too soft.
Once the starfish begin to lose limbs, they die fairly quickly. An article that appeared last spring in the journal Science called the plague the most widespread disease outbreak ever documented in any echinoderm. In Rhode Island, a team of scientists from Brown University, Roger Williams University, and the University of Rhode Island are trying to identify the cause. One of the biggest hurdles, Smolowitz says, is finding healthy starfish to study.
We're trying to look for an infectious agent, so most of our work has been taking starfish that we think are not infected and exposing them to infected animals. And we've been having a hard time getting animals that we think are not infected, number one, and enough of them to do their work with. It's been a trial.
This isn't the first time scientists have seen a dying off of starfish populations. Smolowitz says there was a disease outbreak in the Northeast among starfish in the early 1990s, but populations recovered before the cause could be discovered.
They do have diseases, and it seems like they do undergo some type of epizootic occasionally. Whether those are the same as what we're seeing now, no, we will never know, because we weren't able to identify anything. And it was restricted, localized, and over within one summer. This seems to be going on for quite a while, which is different.
Smolowitz says the wasting disease killing common starfish on the Atlantic coast appears to be the same as that killing multiple starfish species on the Pacific coast, but they can't be sure without an underlying cause.
Whether it's exactly the same disease, we do not know. We don't know what the cause is yet, so until we do that, we really won't know. But it does right now look like it might be the same disease.
Why are scientists so concerned about starfish? Despite being the least intimidating creature in the Ocean Quest touch tank, starfish are voracious carnivores. Smolowitz says they keep in check the populations of other species, like blue mussels, that can otherwise take over an intertidal area and crowd out other small sea creatures.
So the starfish is a keystone species, and it allows for diversity in that intertidal zone. When they're gone, that diversity disappears. That's usually never a good thing.
Back on board Ocean Quest, 6-year-old Abigail Houlihan is happy they've caught at least a few small starfish for her and her little sister to explore.
I see their little eyes. Look at their little eyes. Little sexy.
While these kids learn a little about marine life by handling some common starfish, Roxana Smolowitz and her colleagues in Rhode Island continue to search for the cause of the species' decline. For WCAI, I'm Amy Kolb-Noyes.
And that's our show for this week. This is Living Lab. You can always find Living Lab Radio on Facebook or follow us on Twitter and now Instagram. I'm Heather Goldstone. Thanks for listening.